The house was still and quiet when he woke before sunrise. Outside, there was movement, the murmur of low voices, the sound of animals being led to some place they didn't understand. Inside, his little boy stirred, half awake, half asleep. He asked, "Dad, is today the day?" "Today's the day, son." They walked out into the cool morning air, and the father looped a rope around the neck of the lamb, the one that they had been caring for the last 4 days, the one that they had fed from their own stores, the one they had slept near, the one that the boy and his sister had named Fluffy before the dad could stop him. And in that moment, he held the rope in one hand and his little son's chubby fingers in the other, and they started to walk. The walk to Jerusalem would take a little while, and as the sun rose and more people began to approach the city, which was super busy at this time of year. On Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, hundreds of thousands of pilgrims would come, and so the city was overrun with people. Before they even got into the gates, they could hear the sounds of men haggling at the money-changing table, the call out of the price of a dove today, a goat today, a lamb. But before the sound waves even reached their ears, something else hit them. It was the smell. The smell of fire, of cedar smoke. The incredible mixture of incense and roasted meat hung heavy in the back of the father's throat. But there was something else. It was the metallic scent of blood. These are the smells of sacrifice. As they waited their turn on the stone steps that had been rubbed smooth by millions of sandals over hundreds of years, it felt like a really long time. It was a long time. There were a lot of people to come. At the right moment, the father stepped forward and the priest began to examine the lamb, the one that the father had chosen himself because it was perfect. It had no blemishes, no skin issues, no limp, clear eyes, and he had paid for it a lot more than he wanted to. The priest ran his hand through the soft fur, tracing the spine to make sure there was no curve. And then in a moment, he nodded his approval. "It's acceptable." The father was thinking, "I wish my son was younger. He's old enough to ask questions, but not quite old enough yet to fully understand the answers." As the man took his hands and placed them on the head of the lamb, he could feel its warmth underneath. He pressed harder and could feel the life pulsing through this little animal. In that moment, something was happening that the rabbis had always taught, but he didn't fully grasp. He was substituting. There was something transferring. This lamb would carry weight for that family. Not the weight of groceries and grain, but the weight of a year. The weight of every time he had responded to his wife the way that he knew he shouldn't have. The weight of every time he looked when he knew he should have looked away, and the times when he ignored what he should have seen. It was the weight of every promise broken, the weight of every compromise, every corner cut, and the weight of that distance between him and God that had seemed to grow little bit by little bit with every day that he compromised. At the right moment, his hand reached for the blade, and it was fast. The blood began to flow, and the priest hurried to catch it in a basin. And then the priest turned and walked away, disappeared behind a curtain. The father looked at his son and got the question that he didn't want to have to answer. Dad, why did it have to be this lamb? He paused for a long time, because how do you explain to a kid that this lamb was doing something that they would have been required to do? How can you explain to a kid that sin is not just breaking a rule, it's breaking a relationship? And so he said the only thing that he could. Son, God is making a way for us to come close again. With that, they turned and walked back towards the house, fully aware of two things: that sin was worse than he wanted to believe, and that mercy was greater than he had ever hoped. And the only thing that stuck with him was the gnawing reminder that he'd have to do it again next year. That scene sounds strange to us, doesn't it? I mean, archaic, maybe even disturbing. Some of you are really mad that I named him Fluffy. But that was the experience of the Israelite people for 1,500 years. Sacrifice that was meant to show them and to provide forgiveness and reconnection to the God who loved them. As we've been walking through this Lent series, we're looking at the furniture, the things inside the tabernacle in the temple that Jesus said he came not only to fulfill, but to actually become. And today, we come to a really important element. It's the altar of sacrifice. And you can't really understand the cross on Good Friday if you don't understand what happened at this altar. So in the next few moments, we're going to look at what it teaches us, what it taught these Israelites for all those generations, and what we can learn from today. It teaches us three things. The first thing is the problem. And the problem is this: sin is more serious than you think. Sin is more serious than you think. We live in a world that minimizes sin, you know. We rename it. Some of you don't even like the fact that I just said it. Like, we call it mistakes or bad habits or dysfunction. But God is very clear-eyed about what sin is. It is the rupture of the relationship. From the smallest white lie to the greatest betrayal, every time we choose God or we choose ourselves over God, we choose our way over his way, it is doing something in the fabric of our souls and in the fabric of the universe. We introduce disorder and chaos into a world that God made to be whole, perfect. And it's an offense to a holy and perfect God. It's wild that sin doesn't just shame us. And in fact, God doesn't tell us this truth in order to make us feel ashamed. He doesn't want the gravity and the weight of sin to somehow make us cower. He's trying to explain what it does because he loves us too much to lie to us. And you kind of know how this feels. This morning, I sent a text to the wrong person. It might have been because it was early. I hadn't had the second cup of coffee yet. I'm not sure, but I typed out a text and I sent it and then got a response back. Just question mark, question mark, question mark. Luckily, all the text said was, shoot, I'm sorry, I just sent it. But have you ever sent a text that's a little more damaging than that to the wrong person? Like, you tap it out and It's not like a nice text, you know? It's honest. Maybe it's true. It's harsh. And you meant to send it to your friend, but you end up typing in the wrong name or picking the wrong thread, and it goes off, and you can't get it back unless now you both have an iPhone and you can recall it in the first 2 minutes. But that's beside the point. You sent that text. Have you ever done this? And you know what it feels like when you see those three dots underneath and they're reading it? Oh, it's brutal. Your stomach tightens. Your heart's beating fast. You know exactly what that feels like because you know you didn't just make a mistake. Something just got broken. Maybe the trust with the person. Maybe safety with that person. Maybe the whole relationship. This is what sin is. It's not just the mistake. It's the rupture in the relationship to God. And if that's true, human to human, what happens when the relationship is with the perfect, almighty creator of the universe? Because we all understand that the offense is kind of weighted differently depending on who's been offended. Like, have any of you ever gotten in a scuffle where, you know, when you were younger and less wise, where you punched somebody? You are such cowards. Not one person? All right, I did. And if you punch somebody, that's like a peer or a friend, right? You get in a fight, you deck them, and then the cops show up. They usually have some strong things to say about that whole situation. But what if you punched a police officer? Different story, right? You probably have a sleepover somewhere that's not your own house. What if the person that you punched was the chief of police? Right? Now we're talking. What if you punched the President of the United States? We will visit you in Sing Sing on Thanksgiving. Right? The higher the authority of the person that you offend, the harsher the punishment is. We all get that. So somehow we don't apply that, though, to the Creator, Almighty, perfectly holy, just God of the universe, who says that every time that we sin, it's an offense not just to others, but to Him. This is why the altar existed, to try to help us understand the gravity of this. So in Exodus 29, God gives Moses the instructions for how to teach generation after generation of Israelites about just how weighty sin is. He says this, "You are to offer on that altar regularly, each day, two lambs a year old." Sweet, fluffy. "Offer one in the morning and the other at twilight. For the generations to come, this burnt offering is to be made regularly at the entrance to the tent of meeting before the Lord." So before you could even worship God, before you could get close to Him, the sin and weight of sacrifice was so big. Every day, two baby sheep killed. And then to remind them that this need wasn't just a one-time thing, but it was ongoing, he tells them this in Leviticus 6. "The fire on that altar must be kept burning continuously. It must not go out." And he had taught them through this practice that the only way to be made whole, to repair that relationship, was they needed to substitute a sacrifice for themselves. So in Leviticus 1, he says, "You must present it at the entrance to the tent of meeting so that it will be acceptable to the Lord. You are to lay your hand on the head of the burnt offering." Can you imagine that moment? "And it will be accepted on your behalf to make atonement for you." Why did God do this? Is he just an angry, bloodthirsty, R-rated kind of God? We all know that sin and rupture requires repair. We didn't get asked to make these sacrifices just to appease him. It was because something had to be done to close the distance between us and him that we had created. It's the problem was the cost to repair it was greater than we like to think. And in fact, this is the second thing the altar teaches us. First, that sin is worse than you think. But secondly, grace is more costly than you imagine. I love the word grace. Any of you named Grace? I mean, I like the name. Grace, we're Presbyterians. Grace is like the centerpiece of what we do. Grace, God's undeserved kindness toward us. You can't earn it. You can't deserve it. You can't work for it. He just out of love gives it to you. Ah, we love grace. But grace is free to us, but it is not cheap. It cost God something to be able to give us his grace, because forgiveness is never free. And you know this too. Like, if I came to your house, let's say my car broke down, and Jessica and I had a really important date we had to go on. I needed a vehicle. So I go to your house to borrow your wheels, and you allow me to take it. And when I get back that night and I hand you the keys, the car doesn't look like it looked when I took it away. If I wreck your car, you've got options. First, you're probably going to find another church. Secondly, you got to choose. Either I'm going to carry that debt, I'm going to pay to repair the car, or you're going to forgive me and you're going to absorb it. You're going to cover it for me. Right? There's no two ways about it. Somebody's paying for the car. This is what the altar is trying to show. Sin is either carried by you or it's covered by someone or something else. The altar itself was actually covered. Moses, in his instructions, it's to be built out of wood, but then covered with bronze. So it's something to signify the preciousness of what happened on that altar day after day after day, but also to cover it so that what was placed on top of it wouldn't defile what was underneath. Think about the amount of blood that had sat on top of that altar, something that covered the sin of the people over and over and over again. And then maybe you're like me, and you're asking the question like, okay, I get that. Somebody's got to pay for it. Why blood? Some of you, this is the reason that you don't like Christianity, like you struggle with it, because it's so bloody. I mean, we wear an instrument of execution as an ornament around our neck. We hang them above our worship space. The cross is blood, and we kind of would prefer a more sanitized version, if we're honest, right? Jesus with Fluffy, just kind of playing with him, sweet Jesus, feathered hair probably. We want God to be grandfatherly that can just, you know, give the Thanos finger snap and forgive. Why can't he just do that? Why blood? I have to tell you, I don't know. I mean, I know because God said it, but what I don't understand, because my mind and your mind as finite creatures, we don't think like God does. We don't have the same ability to process, and because of that, he told us why. In Leviticus 17, he says, "For the life of a creature is in the blood." Remember, we have to substitute life for life. "And I have given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life." So it's God's rule. He says, this life that represents, or this blood that represents life, and you know this, no life even comes into the world without blood. This is what I require. Notice, though, that he says, "I have given it to you." There is grace and provision of God in even the sacrifice that he asks for us. Here's a real truth. God will never ask you or me to do something that he also is not willing to empower us to do, to make a way for it to happen. He demands obedience, and then he gives us the opportunity and the ability to obey. This is how gracious God is. He says, "I'm not going to make you come up with, somehow have to figure it out on your own, construct your own sacrifice. I will give it to you." Because grace is costlier than we realize. The only thing that the worshiper, the one who made the sacrifice, the only thing that he had to do was bring it and trust that it worked. That when that priest disappeared around the curtain, which we'll talk about in a couple of weeks, when he disappeared behind the curtain, that whatever happened in the spiritual realm behind that curtain was enough to make him whole for another year. He just had to trust. And in the temple, that happened twice a day, every day, at 9 a.m. and at 3 p.m. Imagine what that would be like in the collective consciousness of a nation, of a group of people. What if our community, every day, twice a day, morning and afternoon, we stopped and we just dealt with whatever had happened wrong since the last time? What if we stopped? We didn't try to distract, we didn't deny, we didn't try to numb ourselves away. What if we looked sin, the brokenness that we all have, square in the face every day and figured out, I have messed up, God is merciful, and here's a way for me to get back with. What if we did that constantly? Can you imagine what kind of healthy and whole people we would be? But we don't. We either believe that it's not that serious and just kind of shoo it away, or we carry it, we feel it, we internalize it. What if we stopped and just named it and then said, God, have mercy on me? That's what Israel lived with, the smoke of sacrifice rising into the sky, reminding them just how broken they were and just how merciful God was. Hebrews 9 tells us, without the shedding of blood, there's no forgiveness. And forgiveness doesn't erase the cost. It just decides who pays it. I think sometimes we tend to think of forgiveness like deleting a file on your computer. Like just highlight, click, gone. Whew. You know that whenever you delete a file on a computer, it doesn't actually go away, right? Our IT guy just helped me understand that. It just makes it to where you're unable to see it anymore, but the file is not gone. Some of you right now are thinking about going home and opening it up like, how do I get rid of that thing? I thought it was gone. It doesn't. It's still lurking in the background. The only way that that file gets to go away is if it's overwritten. If something comes in and absorbs it and overwrites it, it has to actually be dealt with. It can't just be hidden from your view. Forgiveness doesn't erase the cost. It just determines who pays it. Think about the relational pain you've had in your life. The time when somebody has wounded you and you decided, all right, I'm going to forgive and I'm going to try to act like it didn't happen. I'm going to move forward. But you carry that weight. You carry that pain. It is still lurking in the background. You feel it in your emotions, in your bodies, we're even told. The unresolved cost of your car that I wrecked, that's going on somebody's P&L. It's yours or it's mine. And for hundreds of years, people stood where that father stood, one hand on a lamb, watching the cost be played out in front of them and hoping that it worked, knowing that next year they'd have to come back and do it again. But something was happening. There was a shift that God had begun. There was something in the heavenly realm that they couldn't quite see and none of us could quite understand, but God had a plan that was not going to be the way that this continued forever. So in Hebrews chapter 10, it tells us the law was only a shadow of the good things. Those sacrifices, that system, it was just a shadow of the good things that are coming, not the reality itself. For this reason, he says, it can never, by the same sacrifices repeated endlessly year after year, make perfect those who draw near to worship. This is the issue. It could make them covered for a year, but it couldn't change their heart. It couldn't make them perfect. They could still show up, maybe with a shorter list of mistakes, but before a holy God, it didn't matter. They were not acceptable. And then one day God stopped asking for lambs, and he became one. At the beginning of John's gospel, we read this. John sees Jesus walking, and it says, coming toward him, he said, "Look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." Now, that's weird if we'd call somebody that today. But in this moment, anybody who had lived under that system of bringing the lamb himself would have understood this is explosive what John is saying. And notice, I told you that on that Day of Atonement, the Yom Kippur day, the priests would make sacrifice on behalf of the sins of the whole nation. Now John says this is to take away the sin of the whole world. What could possibly do that? It would take something more to finally set the entire cosmos free from this sin. It would take more than a sacrifice. It would take a certain kind of sacrifice. To absorb the cost fully would require a different kind of lamb. So God put flesh and blood on, and he came. He became one of us, maintaining his 100% still fully God and being 100% fully man. Fully man so he could be that substitute, like the lamb that the Father laid his hands on, and fully God so he could handle the weight of all of the sin. That's the only way out. Rather than continue to ask us for the blood of lambs and goats or to condemn us to pay the debt ourselves, rather than leave the deleted file of sin still lurking in the background, Jesus becomes our perfect, full, and final once-for-all sacrifice. In just a minute, the weight of this is going to hit you, and you're going to get pretty excited about what I'm saying. I can feel it. You might even respond. Hebrews 10:12 says, when this priest had offered for all time, one sacrifice for sin, he sat down at the right hand of God. Life for life, no ordinary life. The life of the perfect, sinless, unblemished one. The one that they had called by a name. The one that had become part of their family. The one that had done everything correct. The one that stood quiet and still whenever they pronounced an injust on him. So that he could take away and redeem the injustice for all of us. The one who said, Father, forgive them. They don't even know what they're doing. This is what happened at the cross. He became the sacrifice that would substitute for all of humanity, for you, for me, if we would trust that it worked. We're going to talk about the evidence for that in just a couple weeks. It's an empty tomb. But for now, I just want you to think about this. Knowing what it would cost, knowing how expensive grace was, knowing how far gone you were, Jesus willfully and joyfully said, I'll become the sacrifice. Isn't that good news? Isn't it good that you don't have to carry that weight anymore? You don't have to feel that stuff that we've let store up in our body and our soul. You can let go of it. You're free. Because he wasn't. And like those lambs, those little one-year-old fluffies that got slaughtered at 9 and 3, I love this. God is so about details. Look at this. Mark 15 tells us in the narration of the crucifixion. It was 9 a.m. when they crucified him. And at 3 p.m, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? And with a loud cry, he breathed his last. At 9 and at 3, when the lambs had been slaughtered for generations, Jesus himself becomes the perfect lamb and sacrifice. Tell me God doesn't care about the small things in your life. Tell me God is not interested in exactly where you are at exactly this moment. Tell me that God does not want to show you his goodness and his greatness and his love when he would do something like that. What a savior. Man, this is where it turns to good news. That first half of the message was really heavy. And you probably don't ever want me to tell stories to your kids at night before they go to bed, but here's where it's important, because some of us struggle with this because we don't think sin is that serious. Whatever, mistake, right? Others struggle. I talked with a guy this week like this. Struggle with it because we think it's so serious there's no coming back. And I don't know where you are today. I don't know if you're still carrying around kind of the weight of a failure, of a sin that you committed years and years ago or just this week. The cross answers both of those. The cross says, oh, it's way worse than you thought. And also, grace is way more freely offered than you can believe. The cross says, yeah, it is that bad. And yeah, I'm willing to take care of the cost for you, to absorb it so that you don't have to. This is why Resurrection Sunday is such a big deal. Because Jesus paid it. So I have maybe one question. Said in 3 different ways.
Can you believe this? Will you believe this? Do you believe this? Do you believe it with the reality that a young father with his son felt on Yom Kippur all those days ago? For the skeptic, maybe for you, you're kind of thinking about it. It's hard to believe because you go, yeah, Christianity seems like a cult. It's all the blood and death. Here's the reason. This shows us. It's so real and raw because it's being honest about what's broken in the world and broken in you and me. Maybe you've been a Christian for a long time and you say, yeah, I believe it. But the familiarity with this has gotten to the point that it's blunted the force and the weight of what Christ did for you. Maybe it's time to go back and reconnect to actually what it cost. And maybe for everybody, the question here is the question that had to be asked of that man at the altar. Will I put my hands on it and identify with this? Will I choose to let my sin, my old life, my trying to be God, my trying to do things right, will I choose to let that be transferred to the sacrifice of Jesus Christ so that I can walk free? Here's what we know. That fire that was supposed to never be extinguished, when Jesus breathed and cried out, "It is finished," he put the fire out for good. There's no more fire. There's no more need. And no more lambs have to be brought to be offered because he finished it for us. There's nothing else that you have to do. You can't even provide it yourself, a sacrifice worthy of it. That's why he did. You just have to trust that it works. And so I think that's worthy of worshiping Jesus with and for. I'm going to pray a quick prayer, and we're going to come and we're going to sing one song to just kind of lead in response, a proper response of gratitude for what he's done. And I'm going to ask God in this moment, wherever you are on that spectrum, from sin is no big deal to I am lost forever, that God's love would absolutely invade your heart right now. And you'd become aware of not just how bad it is, but how good he is. Heavenly Father, I ask that you would now come in your power, by your Spirit, you would move on us. You would allow us to experience the weight, not just of sin, but the weight of glory. That you would let those in this room that are walking in guilt and shame, that you would let them for once to place their hands on Jesus and let him take the weight. God, I pray for those who are somehow, we've just gotten kind of numb to the whole thing. God, would you reawaken in us the wonder, the beauty, the incredible love that you have for us. God, would you make us people who are perfect in you, through you, and would you help us to let praise rise, to let gratitude rise, to let go of what's holding us back, and Jesus, trust that whatever happened behind that curtain was enough for us. We pray this in your beautiful name. Amen.